The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten, as it always is, by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. Like to talk to them? They'd like to hear from you at 919-781-1973. And now we're going to open the cover for the second time on the September 2018 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is Camping Carolina Style. And the sort of a title page interior for the series of articles on camping shows two hikers and a dog, and the dog has a pack just like the hikers, but it's not as big as the hikers' pack. And the caption says, Looking Glass Rock Trail near Brevard offers campers an out-and-back hike and views for miles. On the right-hand side of this double-page spread, the sun has just started to peek over this mountain, or set, I'm not sure which it is, and its rays are showing in the graphic, in the visual, the way the lens treats a sharp light. It just looks like these spokes of light coming out the hazy side of the mountain. And the hikers themselves are walking along the top of a large boulder. And they both have hiking sticks. The top of the article has, I guess, the individual articles that are yet to come as we read. We will not get to all of them, no doubt, but they are Find the Best Campsite, Old School Glamping in Piscaforest, Happy Campers at Holly Bluff, Build the Perfect Campfire, Core Sound Castaways, The Making of an Eagle Scout, Have Jerky Will Travel, and My Life in Tents. Here's the opening paragraph for this entire section. Pitching a tent, unrolling a sleeping bag, and starting a fire are the building blocks of a night spent outdoors. Upon them, families create memories that last a lifetime. This month, we present 8 stories about camping. Where to do it, how to do it, what it takes, and what it gives us. Flipping the page over, first thing I see is a picture of the Hatteras Lighthouse, and in front of it some scrubby type of grass that you see on the seashore, and then indeed the sand from the seashore. And then as I shift my eyes to the right-hand page, I see I don't know if you call that a pup tent or not, but it's a small tent. It looks like a semicircle. And in the front, the left side is closed, the right side is open, but there's sort of a circular opening behind that. To the right are two kayaks. They would be kind of difficult to hike a long way and carry, wouldn't they? Anyway, it says, Cape Lookout National Seashore offers a host of camping amenities, easy access to the ocean, a super soft floor to sleep on, and one of the state's largest nightlights. The article's title, Finding the Perfect Campsite. With a little luck and a lot of patience, the campers can score an ideal place to pitch a tent, unless someone else claims it first. Written by T. Edward Nickens. Oh, we have a nice double-leaf photo on the next page. This is beside a river. There's a young man kneeling at a campfire that he's built. There are some trees whose lower branches are just pretty much bare. all around him. There's another one of those tents that looks very similar to the one on the previous page. And again, two kayaks of a different kind this time. These look like inflatable ones. And there's a portable chair set up on the other side of the fireplace. The caption says, "The Paddle In sites at New River State Park provide access to nature that you can't get on foot or by car." It's really quite complicated, although no one seems to understand this but me. We pull up to the campground, and I can sense my family shaking its collective head. "Not this again. Please, Dad, don't make this a big deal." A quiet pall falls over the truck, as if Julie and the kids are holding their breath. We creep along the loop road. It seems to be a rule that all North Carolina State Park campgrounds are laid out along long loop roads, peering at the empty sites. Picnic tables beckon. Smoke rises from recently extinguished campfires. Tension builds until some brave soul says meekly, "That spot looks kind of nice. What about that one?" I gaze out the window and smolder. Can they not see that the ground slopes just enough to tilt you off your sleeping bag? Do they not realize that around the next loop road bend might be the campsite of our dreams? If your family camps, you might have a relative as difficult to please as I am when it comes to picking a campsite. And I am the worst. Choosing a campsite with me is like living inside the Goldilocks and the Three Bears fairy tale. This ground looks a little too rocky. This picnic table is a little too close to the tent. That tent site is at the base of a hill. If there's a flash flood, the water will pour down that gully and swamp us all. Please, Dad. What if the next spot has a better view? What if there's a more private campsite where late night arriving guests won't spotlight our tent with their headlights? What if there's a better place to hang a clothesline? What if we just keep looking for another few minutes? And yes, I know it's almost dark. Complicating the matter is the game show approach to scoring the best campsite, especially at state and national parks. The old school way to snag a site at these campgrounds is to scout out a suitable spot. Let's say Loop C, number 27, and place a cooler or camp chair on the picnic table to stake your claim while you drive back to the campground office to register your find. Meanwhile, everyone else is on the hunt, too, circling the campground loops with lean and hungry looks. It's a little like early pioneers racing for the good land in the old homesteading days. You have to move fast, make a quick decision, and stick to your guns. None of which suit my style. I poke around from site to site, driving the loops time and again, mulling over the merits of C-27 versus B-13. Even when I make a decision and plant my cooler on a picnic table, it's like the Nickens national flag. I second-guess myself. What's the rush? Let's take another loop around the campground. I'm like a dog turning around three times trying to find a place to sleep. My wife, my kids, my pals, whoever is unlucky enough to share my company at the time, wail in anxious desperation. Please, man, could you just choose a spot? If it were only that simple. It's a mighty fine time to be camping in Kakalaki, so I am bracing for another few rounds of anxiety-producing site selection over the next few months. But despite the protests, I prefer to call it whining, of my family, I like to point out that my obsession has paid off big over the years. I've scored some doozy campsites. On Ocracoke Island, one spring break, we packed a pop-up camper between a pair of tall Atlantic dunes that sheltered us from the cool April breezes. It turned out to be a wise move as thunderstorms one night raked the camper with 40-mile-an-hour gusts, and all four of us huddled together in a single bed as hours of lightning lit up the inside of our meager shelter. Under the brow of Grandfather Mountain, our favorite campsite, backed up to a deep creek bed paved with multicolored stones, where the kids would play for hours. There was room for a hammock, camp chairs, and our garish inflatable love seat. We scored that site at least a half a dozen times, although we were always there a week of Thanksgiving when temperatures dipped into the low teens, so to be truthful, the competition for prime spots was pretty meager. There was that site at Jordan Lake, the one with a view of the water through the tall pines, so close to the shore that you fell asleep to the sound of water lapping against the red clay beach. The canoe camp at Merchant's Mill Pond, shared with a dozen barred owls who couldn't have cared less about the state park's posted quiet hours. Temporary quarters, all of them, and all of them a permanent place in memory. Once I've made the gut-wrenching choice between B-21 and D-14, everything gets easier. We all have our duties. My son Jack and I work on the tent, wrestling poles and pole clips and stakes. Julie and our daughter Marky pile up the bedding on the picnic table. It all flows like clockwork. We've done this dozens of times. There's something about putting down tent stakes and raising a cooking fly that feels like making an investment at a little patch of the world. There's a sense of ownership and pride in making 300 square feet of dirt, pea gravel, and picnic table top a home, if only for a night or two. Occasionally, I'll catch a glimpse of another vehicle cruising the campground loop, moving slowly like a vulture gyring over a field, looking for scraps, trying to ascertain whether we're pitching camp or breaking down the tents and heading home. I'll suck in my gut and throw my shoulders back, split a log or two with my bare hands, maybe juggle a few axes. I don't have to say a word. They know what it all means. That's right, Buster. It's the best lot on the block, and it's all ours. You are listening to our state magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. And now, the golden age of camping. Forget roughing it. Our nylon tents, weather apps, and freeze-dried trail chow can't hold a candle to the comforts of camping a century ago. In Piscataquis, the adventures of happy campers like Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and George Vanderbilt inspire classic campouts today. There's a photo here I'm going to start with because it's so interesting to see these three men in three-piece suits standing next to an old mill wheel and an older gentleman with a long white and most unkempt white beard standing in a long white coat down to his ankles. And the caption reads, "The Vagabonds in Western North Carolina on their camping trip in 1918. From left, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, John Burroughs, and Harvey Firestone. They hiked and explored the region, occasionally camping in local farmers' fields, like this one in a picture below in Tennessee. Down there we see a lot of old cars, old Model Ts, etc., and some rather large tents set up. No sides on the tents, or at least not all of them, mainly just a roof, and something in the background looks like an old covered wagon. Imagine camping in a three-piece suit. Thomas Edison rode shotgun, a compass on his knee, to navigate the day's route. Henry Ford got dibs on driving, for obvious reasons. Plus, he was the best mechanic of the group, which came in handy on the rutty and rutted dirt roads they traveled through the Smokies. In the back seat, Harvey Firestone, the rubber and tire magnate, read poetry aloud. The car radio, not yet standard in a Model T, while the famous naturalist and writer John Burroughs sat back watching the North Carolina countryside unfurl at 18 miles per hour, his long white beard barely stirring in the August heat. Nearly every summer from 1915 to 1920, these friends, calling themselves the Four Vagabonds, embarked on an epic camping trip through a scenic American region. They commanded the lead car in a mighty caravan, sometimes stretching 50 vehicles, all packed with essentials for a civilized stay in the woods. Large monogrammed canvas tents, tables and chairs, an enviable library, fishing and hunting gear, and enough household amenities to run an inn, or in their case, a campsite. "It often seemed to me," Burroughs later wrote, "that we were a luxuriously equipped expedition going forth seeking discomfort. If they found any in 1918 on their Appalachian jaunt from Pennsylvania to North Carolina, they didn't let on. A film crew brought along to document the journey for newsreels captured them living it up, which was in part the point. This was the dawn of a new form of recreation. Car camping. The industrialists, whose inventions made the trend possible, believed that modern conveniences could actually bring folks back to nature at a time when so many were trading in rural life for cities. And if Burroughs, who once called the car a demon on wheels, could embrace the idea, the possibilities were endless. As a pastime, camping certainly wasn't new. But as state parks popped up, middle-class people began camping on weekends and for vacation like never before, not with a staff of bow-tied servants like the vagabonds did, but with cots and linens just the same, plus cooking kits, sketch pads for botanical drawings, and novels to read by the fire. It was very popular between 1880 and 1930, That was the golden age of camping, says Wayne Williams, a professor emeritus at Appalachian State University who taught recreation and park management. Model Ts were built so that you could take bolts off and add camper tops and tents to the side. Williams and a group of like-minded old-style campers called the Acorn Patrol gather in state parks several times each year to recreate different types of campsites from this era. They dress the part, but more important, they live in, pitching canvas tents, sleeping on sleepskin padded cots, steeping sumac pots for tea, and cooking over a campfire. In a lot of ways, William says, the way we camp is more comfortable than modern camping. But that's not the only reason he does it. It's a connection to history and to people, really. The chance to cook a Dutch oven blueberry pie outside, for instance, and to share it. Sitting around a campfire allows you to focus on conversation, he says. I think we lose a lot of that in our culture. Over at a tent dubbed the Mackey Mansion, a Victrola warbles an oldie, while the lady of the tent, wearing her suffragette sash, sits in the shade of a raised tent flap, sketching a leaf. Jennifer Mankey and her husband Tom are members of the Acorn Patrol and have come to this gathering in Pisgah Forest bearing all the trappings of a middle-class campsite. The kind, say, a 1918 shopkeeper couple might share. In the same clearing, hemmed in by a split-rail fence, all sorts of campsites are taking shape. There's a roomy wall tent, a few modest and sturdy Welland tents, and several taller wedge tents, the kind sportsmen preferred. Williams can stand in his, and there's room to store his cookery and bamboo fly rod, and to neatly hang his clothes. My hat, he says, feeding the campfire another log, makes a good bellows. The group has gathered on the Biltmore Campus Trail at the Cradle of Forestry near where George Vanderbilt and a large party camped in 1901. Archival photos of that exhibition show gentlemen in derbies and stylish women in long skirts expertly sidestepping brush and chatting among chest-high wildflowers. The Mankeys would have fit right in. Tom Anke, in real life, a naturalist and teacher, demonstrates making a friction fire with a spindle made from a bison rib and buckskin. When a tendril of smoke finally rises from its nest of cattail fluffs, he cups a handful of pine straw around it and blows until his forehead reddens. Smoke beards the lower half of his face, and then suddenly an orange glow appears. Fire! From this one primitive skill, everything else follows. Preserving survival skills like fire making and foraging is central to the Acorn Patrol's mission. Horace Kephart, the North Carolina writer who helped establish Great Smoky Mountains National Park, is the patron saint of the group. His 1906 tome, Camping and Woodcraft, influenced the research and teaching of Acorn Patrol founders Steve Watts and David Westcott. Watts, who died 2 years ago, was a renowned expert in primitive skills and worked for decades with the Scheele Museum of Natural History in Gastonia. The depth of Watts' knowledge is on display in the movie Castaway, in which he and Westcott created survival strategies for Tom Hanks' character. Watts' colleagues from more than 30 years, Suzanne Simmons, remembers learning to cook grasshoppers on hot rocks with him on their early outings. Steve used to say, if someone doesn't know the story of a skill and how to apply it, then it's just arts and crafts. Simmons' campsite replicates the setup used by pioneering women campers, those early naturalists who relished the freedom to be resourceful and resilient in the woods. I've done my share of backpacking in the 1980s style, but there's something about this. It's romantic and rustic, she says. It harkens to a simpler time, a more relaxed pace. But Simmons is quick to point out that it was a very much social experience, too. Camping somewhere, you would get to know the community by trading with the farmers for food, she says. That's how the Vanderbilt's camp cooks got their provisions. It's also how George Vanderbilt got acquainted with his distant neighbors, the farmers and woodsmen who lived around his 180,000-acre estate. Reforestation, timber rotation, soil erosion, all of these topics Vanderbilt bandied about with locals while camping. A trusted friend, local woodsman Ulysses Grant William Reeves, characterized the tall, erudite Vanderbilt as a carefree, happy camper, telling a local newspaper reporter, sometimes he'd take a book and go out in the woods, put his back up against a tree trunk, and spend hours reading. I knew it was a risky thing for an octogenarian to go a gypsying, Barrows wrote, of the Smoky Mountains journey. What did I need of an outing? All the latter half of my life has been an outing, and an inning now seems more in order. Writing in his journals, Burroughs bemoaned the hectic pace of modern life. For the vagabonds, these excursions were meant to be an escape from the pressures of genius. Edison liked to read beneath the trees. Ford goaded his companions into physical contests. Burroughs led nature walks, identifying bird calls and plant species. At night, Edison cranked up a portable generator of his own invention to illuminate the campsite with lights. Even so, the evenings would end, as they have for ages, with friends gathered around a campfire, hashing out bold ideas and sharing long silences. In the daylight, it was harder for the vagabonds to escape their fame. The retinue added a full kitchen car, which Burroughs called the Waldorf Astoria on wheels, and a player piano. Soon their families wanted to come along. And U.S. presidents. The country roadsides thickened with well-wishers and waving fans, and the vagabonds made headlines everywhere they went. Their adventures had popularized a new way to experience the great outdoors, and as a marketing tool to sell cars and tires, and even charcoal for camp cooking. Ford ran a promotion for his cousin-in-law, a man by the name of Kingsford. was a wild success. But Firestone complained that the trips had become a traveling circus. After Burroughs died in 1921, the trio camped together only three more summers. For the Acorn Patrol, Watt's legacy inspires them to continue working to preserve the skills and spirits of early American camping. It's not hard to think of Watts at the cradle, Simmons says, where he discovered an ancient apple tree on the group's first camp out there, gathering wild apples to sweeten sausages and onions blistering in a campfire skillet brings him back, if only in memory. Some years the tree produces, some not, she says with a sigh. But it's such a gift, harvesting from that tree. All of this. A total gift. Written by Louise Jarvis Flynn. I don't think we actually have any articles which are short enough to fit in the last couple of minutes here. We could just take a stab at one around page 34 here. This is called, this is under We Live Here Gathering Place, Fayetteville, a modern mercantile. LeClaire's General Store is a charming hangout for a new generation. The decor draws you in, an authentic mix of antiques, art, and memorabilia reflecting southeastern North Carolina history, beautifully arranged as if in a gallery by owner Patrick LeClaire. Never mind the name, this isn't your grandpa's general store. Patrick left his career overseeing the decor of a national chain of high-end clothing stores to move to Fayetteville and open LeClaire's, tucked in the heart of the Haymont neighborhood. It's general because the handmade pottery is displayed near the pastries. Leafy plants fill colorful hand-woven baskets. Live-edge walnut charcuterie boards hang from hooks. And Pendleton blankets are folded over vintage trunks that sit beside a display of metal ammo boxes filled with locally sourced salves, soaps, and salsas. And like general stores of the past, LeClaire's has become a favorite place to while away the hours. Patrons sip hot coffee and nitro cold brew as they scroll and type and turn pages at picnic tables and in repurposed pews. Later, they'll rehang their mugs on a wall with dozens more, each belonging to a returning customer who can't resist this mercantile for the modern age. If you'd like to visit a modern mercantile, it's at 1212 Fort Bragg Road in Fayetteville. They have a website, LeClaire's General Store. There's a photo of the owner here, and he's pouring some tea or coffee into someone's cup. It says, regulars at Patrick LeClaire's shop find their mugs with names handwritten on the bottom in Sharpie hanging on the wall, soon to be filled with hatchet coffee roasted in boom. And that answers the picture of what the owner is pouring. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our Estate Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our Estate Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Hey, if you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.